The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how flowers that are pollinated by bats are oversexed. Oversexed? What do you mean by that, Dave?
Well, Rob, these bat-pollinated flowers have quite a reputation. They have very large male sex organs, and they also produce a ton of pollen. And pollen is the male flower equivalent of sperm that has to travel to the female flower to produce more plants. Now, researchers have wondered for a while why these flowers that are pollinated by bats produce so much pollen.
A ton of pollen compared to what?
A ton of pollen compared to other plants. In fact, flowers that are pollinated by bats produce about 7 times as much pollen on average as other flowers do, or at least flowers that are pollinated by other flying creatures like hummingbirds. So the question has been, why are they producing so much pollen for bats? And the going theory has been bats are just very sloppy pollinators. You know, they get in there and maybe they're not picking up the pollen very well. So these flowers have to produce a lot of extra pollen to make sure they just even get a little bit on the bats to make sure that when the bats visit the female flowers, they're at least able to transfer some of that pollen. But in this new study, researchers made an observation which led them to believe that this wasn't true, that bats were getting a bad reputation as sloppy pollinators. This research team was looking at bats and bat-pollinated and hummingbird-pollinated flowers in the Ecuadorian rainforest. And what the researchers noticed is that the hummingbirds actually looked a lot more sloppy than the bats did. The hummingbirds would go into one of these male flowers and get this really nice dusting of pollen on their head. But by the time they got to the female flowers, they were only carrying a few pollen grains, versus the bat seemed to be transferring a lot of what they had picked up from the male flowers to the female flowers.
Something different about the hairy bats versus the feathery birds?
Well, that's what the researchers think, that maybe the bat hair is just, you know, a lot more efficient at picking up pollen, or it's just a lot better pollen magnet than feathers are. But they wanted to test this quantitatively. So what they did was they put bats and hummingbirds in cages with male flowers and female flowers, and they actually quantified how much pollen the bats were transferring from one flower to another versus how much pollen the hummingbirds were transferring. And what they found is that the bats transferred about 10 times as much pollen from the male flowers to the female flowers than the hummingbirds did, showing that the bats really do have an undeserved reputation as sloppy pollinators. It's actually the hummingbirds that are a lot less efficient at pollinating flowers than the bats are.
So the experiment was done with these oversexed flowers, as you started by saying. Did the researchers repeat this experiment with the flowers that may be better adapted to hummingbird servicing?
Well, that's a great point. And that's one of the criticisms that's been made of the study, is that the researchers were only looking at these oversexed flowers that have specifically evolved to be pollinated by bats. They did not look at flowers that had evolved to be pollinated by hummingbirds. So you could say, well, maybe the hummingbirds just don't interact as well with these flowers, or these flowers maybe aren't designed as well to be serviced by hummingbirds. And so that the research team says that's what they'd like to do in the next experiment, is to test hummingbird flowers as well, just to make sure that they themselves are not giving hummingbirds a bad reputation.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from a story about breeding in flowers to a story about breeding in ants, this next story is about how inbreeding is bad for ant immunity. You know, we know that inbreeding can be bad for humans. If you look at some of the royal lineages in Europe, you can see that the more inbreeding that took place between members of the royal family, the more problems that their offspring tended to have in terms of various diseases. They also tended to have a lot more problems with their immune systems. They were just less able to fight off diseases. And you also see that in purebred cats and dogs. When the gene pool gets too homogenous, these animals can suffer from a variety of problems, including problems with their immune system. And researchers have actually also seen this problem with ants. They've observed that when ant queens mate with close relatives over several generations, the colonies tend to be less resistant to attacks from fungi, from microscopic worms, and from bacteria. So some of the same potential pathogens that would affect our own immune system. But, you know, when they looked at individual ants, they couldn't look at an individual ant and say, you know, this ant has a problem with its immune system. So they were wondering where the problem was coming from inbreeding. And one of the interesting things about ant colonies is the ant colony is almost sort of like an organism in itself. So when a lot of researchers look at ants, they don't really look at the individual level. They look at the whole colony. And there's actually some interesting parallels between an ant colony and the human immune system. You know, when we have these billions of cells, white blood cells that circulate in our body that help us fight infection, ants themselves in a colony, individual ants will, say, coat a nest with an antibacterial resin that will protect the whole colony. So you can almost think of ants, individual ants, as cells in the giant immune system that is the ant colony. And in the new study, researchers wanted to see, does this analogy extend further? You know, when ants start inbreeding, does it affect the immune system of the entire colony?
So what did the researchers do to try and study this effect of inbreeding?
Well, what they did was they created two colonies of ants, and these ants are a species native to Brazil. And with one colony, they inbred them several times. They bred the queens with close relatives over 10 successive generations. And with the other colony, they let the ants breed with whoever they wanted to breed with. And then they infected these colonies with a parasitic fungus, which is known to eat insects from the inside out. Kind of disgusting. And what they found is that the normal colony, the colony that wasn't inbred, within the first day, this fungus tends to attack the larvae first. These ants in this normal colony started removing infected larvae almost right away from the colony. Just as you might imagine, macrophages in our body come around and they eat pathogens and remove them from our body. These ants were going around and taking larvae, and infected larvae, and taking them out of the colony. But with the inbred colony, sometimes the ants waited up to 3 days before they took these infected larvae out of the colony. By then, the infection had already started to spread beyond the larvae. So the researchers are really finding that on the colony level, that when ants inbreed, the whole colony can suffer in terms of becoming much more vulnerable to a parasitic infection.
So does that mean that researchers have found something that's wrong on the individual level with ants?
Well, what they suspect is happening is that individual ants that are not inbred are better able to sense when a larvae is infected with a parasite. Maybe it's something that ants don't really smell, but it's maybe something they detect chemically, and that the inbred ants just have a much harder time detecting this quote-unquote infected smell or whatever it is. And that's why the inbred colony as a whole takes longer to remove these infected larvae. Now, you know, as I said before, the researchers had looked at individual inbred ants and hadn't seen problems, but that doesn't mean those problems aren't there. And what the researchers are arguing in this study is, you know, if we looked close enough and if we really studied the physiology or the chemical sensing of these ants, perhaps we would detect some defects at the individual level that, in the long run, impact the entire colony.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from figuring out how ants deal with inbreeding to figuring out how woolly mammoths dealt with sub-zero temperatures in prehistoric Siberia and North America.
What's the new data?
Well, the new data comes from a 43,000-year-old mammoth bone preserved in the Siberian permafrost. And this bone was actually discovered quite a while ago, and researchers have been doing various experiments with these remains to really try to figure out how these ancient beasts lived and even potentially what drove them extinct. And in this new study, one of the quick questions the researchers had is, how did these animals adapt to such cold conditions when the animals they evolved from actually were adapted to much warmer conditions? It's thought that woolly mammoths split off from an elephant-like African ancestor over tens of millions of years. And some of the adaptations that the mammoths evolved was that they evolved tiny ears, potentially for blocking out snow, and very thick wool, you know, very obvious adaptations. But this new study, researchers were wondering, was there something else that was happening, you know, on sort of a more of a physiological level that really helped these animals adapt? And they specifically focused on a protein called hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is this protein that in animals helps transport oxygen. And hemoglobin basically holds on to oxygen. And the warmer tissue gets, the more likely it is to release oxygen. And that really helps. If you've got a very hardworking muscle, you obviously want more oxygen delivered to that muscle. So the warmer the muscle gets, the more oxygen hemoglobin is releasing to that muscle, and the more quote-unquote breathing that muscle can do to keep functioning. But what may have been different about woolly mammoths is that it's been speculated that to sort of keep their core body temperature warm, they would have let their extremities, say their legs, get very cold. But that poses a conundrum, because if you let your extremities get very cold, and when you've got hemoglobin down there, how is the hemoglobin going to release oxygen? You still need some oxygen delivered to those extremities, otherwise they're going to effectively die. And so the researchers wondered, you know, was there something that was different about mammoth hemoglobin that allowed it to deliver oxygen even to these very cold extremities?
So with the DNA from this really old fossil.
Exactly. So what they did with this really old DNA was they were able to match that up with what is known about the mammoth genome and actually isolate the gene for mammoth hemoglobin. And then what they did was really neat was they inserted this gene into a bacteria, actually E. coli, in the lab, and they had the bacteria manufacture mammoth hemoglobin. And it may sound far-fetched, but we already do that with insulin. We've inserted the human gene for insulin into E. coli bacteria, and E. coli produce human insulin. And so that's what researchers did in this study. They had the bacteria produce mammoth hemoglobin, and they also had the bacteria produce hemoglobin from modern Asian and African elephants, which are the closest living relatives of the woolly mammoth.
So how did the two compare?
Well, what they found is sort of what they expected, that the warmer a tissue got, the more oxygen the African and Asian elephant hemoglobin released. But with a woolly mammoth hemoglobin, it released oxygen at a steady rate regardless of temperature.
Are there other possible explanations for what's going on here that researchers are considering?
Well, one researcher makes the critique that we really don't know. We're just sort of assuming that these woolly mammoths would have potentially had a problem with oxygen delivery to these colder tissues, and they would have needed to solve this problem with this type of hemoglobin that releases oxygen regardless of temperatures. But that is a big assumption, considering we don't really know very much about the physiology of these animals. The extraordinary thing here that the outside experts are really excited about is that the researchers were even able to produce this 40,000-plus-year-old hemoglobin in the lab. In fact, the team actually compares it to taking a 43,000-year-old blood sample from a woolly mammoth. So still a very impressive achievement, even if not all experts are totally convinced about this different function of woolly mammoth hemoglobin.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got stories about the genetics behind Tourette syndrome and the largest bulge in the solar system. And for Science's policy blog, Science Insider, we are very closely following this oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, what it means for science, what scientists are doing to try to help clean it up. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.